From the Witherspoon Concert Hall in Omaha's Joslyn Memorial, KIOS-FM proudly presents another program from the Utah Holly Lecture Series. We'll hear a talk given by Tony Award-winning Broadway producer Adam Epstein. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, May 9, 2005, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Utah Holly Girls Village, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce today's speaker is Sarah Young, chairman of the Utah Holly Lecture Series Board.
When our daughter Joanna graduated Westside and went off to NYU, we knew she'd meet some special people and make a lot of new friends, which she did. But little did we realize that her best friend would turn out to be Adam. And he actually, when Joanna and Jeffrey were married, Adam was the honor attendant. And we just enjoy having him come to Omaha, and we like to see him when we're in New York. I think he's been coming now 12 or 13 years. So when our committee decided to ask him to speak, I was really thrilled. So now I introduce you to a very special person who has adopted us as his Midwest family, Adam Epstein.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me? Yes? First, I just want to thank Sarah for that amazing introduction. You know, it's not every day that you get to have several moms. I have a mom, and I have a stepmom, and I have a Midwest mom, and I have a California mom, and it's wonderful. So I want to especially thank Sarah. I also want to thank the Utah Holly organization for this, and of course, acknowledge some of the high schools that are here from Central, South, and West Side today, and some of those drama students. Thanks for being here. I hope you pursue your dreams, too. And I always think it's a tremendous joy to come back and visit the heartland, and I mean that affectionately. It's been a little over a decade or so that I've been coming to Omaha and visiting and calling it a surrogate home. I think I'm now a Husker. I wouldn't dream of being anything else. Give Huskers a round of applause. Come on. There you go. I couldn't dream of being anything else but a Husker. And I just have a blast when I come here. We stay real busy. We go to the Hy-Vee, and then we go to Baker's, and then we go to the Hy-Vee, and then we go back to Baker's, and then we go to Father Flanagan's Boys Town and Gerald Ford Birthplace, and I just sort of scope the town out and then finish everything off at the Omaha Zoo. So that's what we do every trip, and we just love it. So if you want to ever see me when I'm here, just come down aisle 4 at the Hy-Vee, and there I'll be. But nevertheless, I think that the Utah Holly organization is so enormously generous in what they're doing and special in what they're trying to say in both the activities they provide, the services they provide, and the difference they're making in people's lives on a day-to-day basis. Suffice it to say, I've been very blessed in my own life. I would say that I'm going to start by talking about some of the highlights of that. About 3 years ago, I journeyed off to Seattle, Washington, to try out a musical called Hairspray. And I arrived in Seattle and thinking it might be somewhat dreary and filled with the jitters. Shows typically go out of town before they arrive on Broadway, and we had chosen Seattle for our pre-Broadway tryout for the show Hairspray. And adapted from the 1988 John Waters movie of the same name, Hairspray could very well be called Spray of Hope. It's an amazing story about an energetic and plus-sized teen named Tracy Turnblad. She's the story's enormously sympathetic heroine, and she pretty much changes the world, her world and the world around her, for the better. The show's set in Baltimore in 1962, where Tracy and her agoraphobic mom, Edna, find that the roads to stardom are often paved with hope. Optimistic in nature and indefatigable in spirit, Tracy wins a spot on a local television dance show called the Corny Collins Show. Not unlike the actual show upon which it's based, the Corny Collins Show has one hitch. It prohibits children of color in the Baltimore area from dancing on the program, with the exception of one day a month. Now Tracy, infused with the will to change and the will to succeed, makes it her mission to integrate the show. Little does she know that along the way, she's going to meet the boy of her dreams, the hunky, swivel-hipped Link Larkin, whose heart she steals and who steals her heart, and of course sees a past the cultural stigma of her being an outsider, in this case Tracy being overweight or plus size, and accepts her for who she is, no qualifications and no questions asked. I think the best summary of not just what the show has to say, but the experience that people take from it, and the experience and the profound impact it's had on all of us as creators, were summarized in one of the reviews of the show when it opened in New York, in the New Yorker magazine. The critic's name is David Denby. He's the regular film critic, and we were lucky to have him review us when Hairspray opened on Broadway. Denby says, "While you are watching Hairspray, it's hard to imagine that there is anything that matters but singing and dancing in life. Yet, Hairspray is much more serious about self-realization than it is about race. The Turnblads, mother and daughter, come out of the Hefty Hideaway specialty shop in matching outfits of iridescent paisley and feathers. And Harvey Fierstein, then playing Edna, makes a grand entrance in the climax of the evening in flaming pink. Hairspray tells us to be proud of what we are, which is hardly an original sentiment on Broadway. You might even say it's the essential message of all musical comedy, since singing and dancing are often the expression of buried desires. But the show triumphantly combines so many forms of theater. Drag review, rock musical, R&B concert, social protest play, tenderloin burlesque, that its conventional ideas soar above cliche, elevated by stunning professionalism and gusts of love. The happiness of dancing, of dressing up, being fat, being black, being gay, being straight, there isn't much that's not celebrated by this show before it sends its audience out of the theater strong and confident and ready for anything." So such magic indeed came to startling life from the moment Hairspray premiered at Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater, and then on to its extraordinarily high glitz and an enormously emotional Broadway opening night, which was both an experience for not only those people involved, but for a city and a country, and particularly Manhattan, that was looking for a post-9/11 antidote. When the show opened in Seattle, I had many people come and grab me in the aisle during previews and say, "Are you involved with this show? Are you behind the show?" And I thought I was getting in trouble or something. I thought maybe we offended somebody. And they would compliment. They would laud. They would say, "Not only do we love this show," which of course is always music to a producer's ears because that means they're going to buy some tickets, or their friends are going to buy tickets. They would say, "We need this. This is what we're looking for now. We're battered by a recession. We feel like our country's in great peril, and this is something of a tonic for us." So there was enormous satisfaction derived from that. Subsequently, Hairspray had a robust premiere of its national tour, which is still playing. It came home to Baltimore to do that in September of 2003, and it continues to play these multi-week engagements across the country. But I think that the great joy that I've derived from being part of this watershed, what I think is this watershed experience, is seeing that the musical can still believe in the pleasure principle, and that possibility and hopefulness and a refreshing lack of cynicism, all things I think would be tough to argue that the Uta Hagley organization believes in, can be transferred 8 times a week, week after week, year after year. And the healing power of a seemingly frivolous musical like Hairspray can be nothing short of transformative. And I think it takes on that kind of larger significance in its joy because it's satire, and it's got a message, but it says it with a smile, and it says it with a lot of hope. And I think when entertainment transports, it transcends. I think when entertainment heals, it cleanses. When entertainment celebrates, it resurrects. Ironically enough, and although an avid fan of musical comedies, my theatrical influences were far different from shows like Hairspray. The British pop opera, which dominated Broadway for many years, embodied by theatrical heavyweights like Les Miserables or The Phantom of the Opera and Cats, gave Broadway a virtually 2-decade-long dalliance with bombast melodrama and chest-pounding romanticism. These musicals, you might say, took themselves rather seriously and, to be sure, sought a different kind of dramatic enchantment, whether it be a masked demon hiding beneath the Paris Opera House or an unfairly convicted prisoner on the road to redemption. But the musical's message was still clear, and its impact remained the same. What does theater do? What can theater do for us? How can theater move us? How can theater transform and change us? For 2.5 hours, 1,500 people would soak in the immediacy, as well as in what's unfortunately the ephemeral pleasure of being in a live theater for that limited amount of time. Of course, the only tragedy about ever seeing a great show is that its magic and its heart, its intoxication, does exist only momentarily, since live entertainment of any kind is, after all, evanescent. Still, is what we take away from our shared collective experience in that building, be it for a show or a concert or what have you, that leaves a lasting impact. It was this seminal aftershock that was so impactful upon me way back in 1979 when another woman in green, not the woman who's green and filled with envy, flying above audiences now in Broadway's Wicked. But your first speaker next year, Sandy Duncan, who was sprite and spunkily clad in an earthy forest green back in the late 70s, doing a revival of Peter Pan. I arrived in New York when I was 18 years old to attend New York University. I was born, however, and raised in Miami Beach, a certainly sunny and friendly environment, which I don't know that completely prepared me for the challenges and triumphs which lied ahead. True, at 18, I may have still had the same immeasurable level of overachiever syndrome. I was bursting with ambition, probably with a bit of insanity. Although I think my journey is not unlike most people's, though. And although it's been a successful path thus far, the avenues which led me to where I am today were hardly linear. After all, what on earth and how can you find a practical application for a love of Broadway and showbiz and a strong passion for legislative politics? Well, one might say that the lines between politics and entertainment have now and possibly more than ever blurred into one another, for better or worse. But I think that my internships, which I was fortunate to do on Capitol Hill for senators and congressmen both, and subsequently for Mayor Giuliani in New York, prepared me for my role as a producer. I made a pact with myself to do the very best I could, and it makes me always think of this great Abe Lincoln quote that I love. Lincoln said, "I do the very best I know how and the very best I can, and I mean to keep doing so until the end. If the end brings me outright, what is said against me won't amount to anything. If the end brings me out wrong, 10 angels swearing I was right will make no difference." I love that quote. And I also love another quote. I was fortunate enough when I was in New York to visit a friend who had a wise old sage of a grandmother in the Bronx who told me once, "Do good and forget about it. Do bad and think about it." And I've kept that with me as sort of a touchstone in my life because I think there's a lot behind that. I think all you can do in life is give back, be the best person you are, imbue anything you do with integrity. You know, this quote always reminds me about how treachery and dishonesty should never be a partner with ambition. And of course, what can animate great work in the arts is if something that is done with honesty, with believability, and really with values. And I think values, unfortunately, is a word that's abused nowadays. For better or worse, I think it's abused by phony politicians, by phony moralists, and I think values are personal things. But I think we all agree that values are important, that you say what you mean, that you have integrity with what you do, and then instead of being constantly cynical, maybe you have a little bit of hope. Maybe tomorrow is better than today. Maybe those things still are possible. Those are my values. And I think that's one of the great things about producing, because you have to hold on to that, because it's a thrilling high wire act, both in development of a project. Something like a Hairspray took 3 years to mount till that day. 1999 we started. It wasn't until 2002 that I sat in that Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle on that rainy May 31st to watch the premiere of this wonderful show. But in developing the project and ultimately mounting it, this big high wire act always begs the question, which I get everywhere when I speak, when I've taught, what does a producer do? Well, producers do a lot of things in many ways. I always say, I think producers are alchemists, really, is the best way to sum it up. We have to battle, we have to engage, we have to stimulate, but we always have to spin mundane metals into gold. And I think that that is a surefire way to approach it with success and with a certain kind of sturdiness that the career demands. But for all of the unanswered questions, how and what actually makes a producer is often guided by some of life's most basic principles too, sort of kind of spiritual underpinning that I think we need to cling on to as individuals to make that happen. I just read a wonderful book about the legendary film mogul Louis B. Mayer. I recommend this book highly to everybody in this audience. The author is Scott Eyman, E-Y-M-A-N. And as you know, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer is a studio which for 80 years existed as sort of the central studio, early 60 of the 80s, as a central studio of Hollywood, has now been acquired by Sony and is no more. The lion that roared on front of all those classic movies and even recent movies, it's gone. And this book talks about the man who ran that studio in its golden age, the age of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and Casablanca and those type of things. Anyway, Louis B. Mayer was a creative entrepreneur. He believed in a dream factory. He believed in having gusto and ambition. He was an Eastern European immigrant without any education. And there's a great moment early on in the book when a young Louis Mayer, he's living with his family in St. John. He was an immigrant from Tsarist Russia, came into Haverhill, Massachusetts, and then ended up in St. John, or actually the other way around, St. John and then Haverhill, Massachusetts. But he got into a tussle, a young Louis did, with a kid in school. He was frustrated. He was beaten down. And he screamed out in front of the valley ahead of him, "Damn you," he said. Now, his mother, Sarah, a religious woman, told her son both to watch his language and also he should yell out back to his antagonists, "Bless you." And she said, "Which do you prefer, my son? It is entirely up to you. That is the way life is. It always returns to you what we say to it. If you shout out at your fellow man, 'Damn you,' life and your fellow man will shout it back at you. If you say to life and to humanity, 'Bless you,' then your life will be the echo of these words, 'Bless you.'" As time went on, Mr. Mayer would always comment that what his mom told him at a young age was confirmed through his experiences. He said later in years, "If I put hatred and meanness and revenge out into the universe, I would get it back. If I tried to speak of love, kindness, and forgiveness, it would be returned to me." I use this example always because I think it's very easy to lose hope or lapse into despair and not take enough time to realize that although you may have to spend your life dodging bullets, there's hardly ever a need to shoot back. I also think as producers, we choose stories to create that in one way or another are ultimately some kind of great manifestation of who we are, of what we believe in, and of what kind of message we want to send. People always ask me if being in show business is always this great struggle. You know, is it hard to beat the odds, which are not in your favor? Can it shake your faith in the future? And I always say, how on earth can you be in a business this competitive and rugged and not be an optimist? I said, for crying out loud, I'm a congenital optimist, and I always will be. Because if you don't believe it, it certainly won't happen. And in order to actualize and activate the wonderful things that need to come out of whatever creative work you're working on, you have to cling tenaciously to notions of hope and possibility. Because it's only if you believe it. And by believing it, I don't just mean believing it internally. I mean sending out those messages that can come back as blessings, that a dream can be turned into a lasting and wonderful reality. I always love to discuss the different spiritual elements which guide me, and I think that thread has run through my life. I fell in love with musicals, specifically beginning with Peter Pan, because I think what could be more enchanting, I thought, than a young boy who refuses to grow up but is never afraid to fly. It's in musicals that I believe that people can see their dreams take shape and take flight. In much of Broadway history, the words musical and celebration were inextricably linked to one another. The musical, at least for most people, always had and still wants to have as broad a communication, as mass an appeal as possible. Now, John Lahr, also of The New Yorker, son of Bert Lahr, is the drama critic, and he expands upon this. "When you're talking about the American musical," Lahr says, "you are talking about Broadway religion, the salvation of applause, the beatification of the bottom line, the gospel of good times. What America is the new musical singing about? Vietnam put paid to legends of abundance and righteousness, which were formerly the musical's manifest destiny. The musical lost its confidence in its content, in its form, its audience, and its country. German fairy tales, French pointillism, Victorian England, 30s Berlin, many of the most celebrated recent musicals seem prepared to sing about anything but America. Musicals gave the society, and our society specifically, myths of triumph. Now with society's retreat from power, the musical is making myths of anxiety." Lahr continues on, "The musical was fun before it was art, but give or take a few blips of buoyancy, most notably Hair, the chorus line, or Chicago, anxiety has become the new abundance. The musical, like the winded culture it reflects, seems at a loss to know what or how to celebrate. Pluck and loathing has been replaced by pluck and luck. Pluck and loathing has replaced pluck and luck as the prevailing credo. The delirium of hope that a great musical comedy can bring is now oftentimes giving way to the delirium of despair. The more he bleeds, the more he lives," chants the chorus about from the Demon Barber of Fleet Street and Stephen Sondheim's masterpiece, Sweeney Todd. Lahr says these lines could be the epitaph of the sour dreams and the articulate entropy that the paying customers have been asked to applaud in these wilderness years, where joy, key word joy, has been banished from the contemporary musical's definition of maturity. I think what Lahr's encapsulated there for us, and this was a pre-Hairspray, pre-producers, contemporary quote, is very much the reason I seem more than tickled with the possibility, or I seemed more than tickled, making the possibility of Hairspray a musical. Because Hairspray is many things, and there are varying views on what it has to say and what its impact will ultimately be, but there's no mistaking its central message, that 2.5 hours of unbridled joy can be every bit as cathartic as a Greek tragedy. And Hairspray believes in a religion that it does, and that religion is hope. Now, in recent years, and I think Laura's smiling a little bit more nowadays, shows like Hairspray and The Producers, last year's Tony winner, the subversive but very affectionate Avenue Q, and Broadway's current smash, the delightfully silly Spamalot, which is a musical of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, have definitely brought good times back with a vengeance. They've also proven that, as was the case with Broadway for so many years, that vast artistic achievements could span commercial profits. All these musicals share both the sanction of the critical establishment, more or less, and that belief in what audiences were screaming at me and grabbing at me for back in Seattle. The tonic, the antidote, the intoxication, the joy, particularly at a time when we as a community continue to be tested by challenges both here and abroad, and the sense of healing about this. Now, just yesterday, President Bush was marking the commemoration of the Allied victory in World War II over in the Netherlands, and he said, "Freedom is a permanent hope of mankind." I'd like to turn that around for him. I think hope should be a permanent, and should be permanent for all of mankind, and should be a sense of freedom. That's what I think. Now, I feel incredibly lucky to be part of this exciting new vortex of possibilities of the musical. Long associated with stodginess and earnestness, I think it's starting to feel like a hipper, trendier element of our pop culture. I know I couldn't have foreseen a Broadway bursting with excitement 7 years ago when I started working as a young producing associate. 7 years prior to that, when I'd come to NYU, most of the theaters were dark, save for a few of the big British mega hits like Phantom and Les Mis. Currently on Broadway, and we're getting into the spring Tony season right now, all 33 Broadway houses are booked. As I went on to proudly produce revivals of very important stage plays like Peter Schaffer's Amadeus, which I did early on, both in London and New York, Arthur Miller's The Crucible, which we were lucky to have Liam Neeson star in for us, the raucous soiree, I call the American musical, was always in my heart, and I always envisioned my role both as a champion for it and an impresario of it. It wasn't that long ago, says John Larrigan, my best friend, that the Broadway musical, which glorified its risk capital as angels and its entrepreneurial talent as stars, made a legend of show business. I mentioned Louis Mayer. You'll know names like Hal Prince, David Merrick, Cameron McIntosh, Samuel Goldwyn. This is movies and theater here together. Harry Cohn, the Warner Brothers. Guys with just the come-from-behind guts and stamina, creative vision, willingness to not just put their buck on the line, but to put their soul on the line for what they believed in. I think Woody Allen's quip remains resonant to this day. If it wasn't a business, it would be called Show Show. Not unlike Tracy Turnblad herself, I think my successful showbiz journey at this point in my life has left me brimming with confidence and eager to tackle the many challenges which lie ahead. I think I'm going to borrow some pages from Tracy's playbook, a dogged, hungry, and committed girl, person that is, eager to make a difference. Still, I may only have been 5 when I first witnessed it, and I may only have been 22 when I dove into it. I may have been 28 when I was emboldened by it, but I can't imagine having lived a life without dreams. Success and character, virtue and accomplishment, and purpose are all the inevitable byproduct of dreams. I think dreams that have to be believed in, dreams that have to be lived by and fought for. Dreams which can't be weakened by cynicism. Dreams which can't be withered by setbacks. And as Hairspray readily attests, you have to remain hopeful about your dreams, if not completely loyal to your dreams. But most importantly, you have to be ready and able to seize those dreams at the moment they become fulfilling and the possibility of being fulfilled, and move steadily with them like the wind. As Henry David Thoreau once said, and this was also my senior year quote, if one advances confidently in the direction that he or she chooses, and if one dares to imagine that anything is possible, then one will be met with a success unexpected in common hours. And like our lovable Tracy, and not unlike myself for that matter, I think the girls at Utah Holly are being given a chance, a second chance, at several things, a chance at renewal and regeneration, promise of a better tomorrow. And no doubt with this will come hope and hopefully a legacy of people that feel that somebody believed in them and in turn they were able to start over. And of course, the possibility that promise And dreams can be an antidote to despair. I really want to thank you for having me speak to this extraordinary organization. And I hope in your travels, in which I wish you all Godspeed and God bless, you continue to soldier forward confidently, purposefully, knowing full well that the best weapon against life's most daunting obstacles can be and will always be hope. Thank you. Okay.
You've been listening to a program from the Utah Holly Lecture Series. We've heard a talk by Tony Award-winning Broadway producer Adam Epstein. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, May 9th, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Randy Figura for his help in the recording of this program. Special thanks also to Tracy Wells for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Audio cassettes and CD copies are available for $15. Send a check or money order to Utah Holly Girls Village, care of Tracy Wells, 3017 Mormon Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68112-2205. All proceeds from the sale of tapes and CDs will go to benefit the Utah Holly Girls Village. Please allow 3 to 4 weeks for delivery. The next lecture in the series will be Monday morning, October 17th at 11 o'clock. The guest speaker will be television and Broadway actress and dancer Sandy Duncan. If you'd like to attend this or other lectures in the series, call the Utah Holly Girls Village at 453-0803. Tickets for this lecture will be available at the door the day of the event. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.